Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, a measure that would bar transgender girls from K-12 girls' sports in Utah stalls. In a Senate committee, a bill to allow a name change for Dixie State University appears to have life again. A House committee advances a bill to definitively block cities and counties from creating firearms regulations. And Deb Haaland is poised to become the first Native American in history to head a cabinet agency. On the phone for this discussion, we have Salt Lake Tribune reporter, public lands reporter Brian Maffley. Thanks for being here, Brian. I think I got you. Are you there? We will find out. We've also got Brian. Are you there? Just checking. All right, let's try with Taylor Stevens. Are you there with us this morning? Hello. Good morning.
I am. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning to you. And we do have Brian coming in just a second here. And also news columnist Robert Gerke. Welcome to you, Robert.
Good morning, Roger.
And I'll go back to Brian Maffley. Do we have you on the phone?
I'm on the phone, yeah.
Thank you. Glad to have you on the phone. Thanks for being here. And listeners, a reminder that you can join this discussion with your questions and comments by calling us. The number is 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. The hashtag is at KCPW. This week, you know, we generally, for the past couple of weeks, have been starting at the legislative session, and let's go somewhere else for the beginning of the show this week. And Brian Maffley, now that we have you on the line, Tribune Public Lands reporter, whoever ends up leading the Department of the Interior under any administration, the agenda that they set has a pretty sizable influence on the state of Utah, because Utah has a lot of public lands, and the Interior Department is in control of those lands, or of the policies that govern those lands. This week, President Joe Biden's pick to lead the Interior Department, Deb Haaland, faced some scrutiny, some vetting in confirmation hearings. Actually, before we go there, let's get a reminder of who Deb Haaland is, and who she is and what her background is, and then we can go to those confirmation hearings. Who is Deb Haaland?
Yeah, you bet, Roger. Well, Deb Haaland's a member of the Laguna Pueblo of New Mexico. She would be the first Native American to serve in a presidential cabinet if she's confirmed, which is just in and of itself historic, especially since the Department of Interior also oversees the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which, you know, historically has had a bad track record of looking after the interests of Native Americans. So that said, Haaland is a second-term congresswoman representing the district around Albuquerque, which is not very far from her home, Pueblo. And she has, previously run for Congress on a platform of severely restricting the energy industry's access to oil and gas on public lands. And which is sort of in line with what the Biden administration is pursuing now. And so she has, she's facing a lot of criticism over that in her Senate confirmation hearings over the last few days.
Let's go back to the gauntlet, to those, those confirmation hearings. In particular, she faced some questioning by Utah's Senator Mike Lee. This is in the Senate Natural Resources or Energy and Natural Resources Committee. National monuments were the topic that he keyed in on.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that exchange between Senator Lee and
Well, that was pretty interesting. Yeah, Senator Lee didn't really harp on Deb Haaland too much on those energy issues. He was much more interested in how she would oversee President Biden's review of the previous administration's move to severely reduce the size of Utah's two national monuments, Bear Hills and Grand Staircase Escalante. That was his big issue. And frankly, he was one of the nicer Republicans to Deb Haaland, actually. But he made it very clear that these large monument designations by Democratic presidents have not gone over too well in Utah. It is true that there is some degree of local support for those big monuments, but he wanted some assurances from her that she, when she conducts these reviews, that she will be listening to you know, locally elected leaders and state leaders in Utah before she makes any recommendations to President Biden about what to do with those monuments. Now, of course, you know, everyone's expecting Biden is going to put those monuments back the way they were originally designated. So, you know, Bill Clinton designated 1.9 million for Grand Staircase, 1.9 million acres, and Obama designated 1.3 million for Bears Ears. Now, collectively, Donald Trump cut about 2 million acres from those two monuments. I mean, really, really big reductions. And that really angered a lot of groups out there that thought the monuments were fine the way they were, especially the five Native American tribes that had petitioned the Obama administration to designate Bears Ears. They not only want to see that monument restored, they want to see it bigger. And, you know, that might be on the table here, a bigger Bears Ears.
Wow.
And we'll see. So clearly, you know, Mike Lee has a lot of problems with the way the Antiquities Act has been used in Utah, and he at times was suggesting that Utah deserves some kind of exemption from, you know, future designations under the Antiquities Act. You know, I mean, not to say that there won't be national monuments, but there needs to be, you know, buy-in from the state legislature or something, which in some ways is, you know, there's never going to be a big national monument in Utah if it requires approval from the state legislature. It's just never going to happen.
You pointed out that national monuments were, you know, just one part of this, and that also the extraction of fossil fuels, where you began, the leasing on public lands, climate change. In fact, one of the senators on this committee described the hearing as a sort of a proxy fight over the future of fossil fuels. Is that an accurate description?
I think so, very much. There's the Republicans on that particular committee, John Barrasso of Wyoming, Steve Daines of Montana, in particular, are very concerned about the Biden administration cutting off access to oil and gas and coal resources on public lands in their states. So, without, you know, reevaluating whether the federal government is going to make those resources available, you know, it's hard to tackle the climate change question. And Biden is, he's done so far is he's enacted what he's calling a pause on further oil and gas leasing on public land. Okay, the Republicans in the Senate keep referring to it as a ban on oil and gas. It's not a ban at all. And Deb Haaland repeatedly had to say, we're not banning oil and gas on public lands, or Biden is not. He is putting a pause on the program to review whether it's a good deal for the taxpayers, good for the climate, and they'll start again. The fact is, there's so much, 20 plus million acres of land, mostly in western states, that's already under lease for oil and gas. You know, most of it isn't even developed yet. It isn't really going to put the industry out that much to pause oil and gas oil and gas leasing.
Yeah.
Existing leases can still be developed. They're still going to be issuing drilling permits. So she was trying to dispel this idea that the Biden administration's actions are going to have this really negative impact on oil and gas production in the West. I really think he's right about that. However, those senators are right to be concerned because we can see where this is headed. A severe reduction in the amount of oil and gas leasing and maybe coal leasing as well is probably in the future here. And Deb Haaland, if she's confirmed, would be the person, the Interior Secretary, that would implement that program. So in a sense, those senators are right to really, give us some tough questions here. I think where they kind of went too far is, using her positions that she's held, she took as a candidate for Congress in New Mexico, and holding those against her. I mean, she's now not representing, as an Interior Secretary, she won't represent the city of Albuquerque anymore. She's going to be enacting the policies of President Biden. You know, those policies are what they are, regardless of who the Interior Secretary is.
Sure. And I guess you mentioned that you mentioned Senator Steve Daines from Montana, Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming. They were essentially trying to block her confirmation. Daines referred to her as having, quote, hardline ideologue, or being a hardline ideologue with radical views. Are they still trying to do that? And, you know, whether or not they're trying to do that, is Holland on track to be confirmed as Interior Secretary?
I think it's going to be a close vote. That Energy Committee's chairman, Joe Manchin, a Democrat of West Virginia, he's already thrown his support behind her, and that's significant. He represents a pro-coal state in West Virginia. He's probably the most conservative Democrat in the Senate. His support means a lot. And when he announced he would vote to confirm her, I think that really bodes well for her confirmation.
Okay. I'm going to go to Robert Gerke, who is a news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. And Gerke, you lived in D.C. for a time. You covered a variety of the doings of government there. Now you are an opinion columnist and not a reporter, but maybe we can shed some light on how common or how uncommon this kind of fight over someone like an Interior Secretary or any cabinet position is. And I don't know if this is what's happening, but is the potential for a party line confirmation votes on cabinet nominees, if that's what happens here, is that normal?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've seen a few of these split largely along party lines. This one is also, you know, Deb Haaland's nomination is obviously one that's of particular interest to the Western senators. So, I mean, it's going to be it could be a bit of a tussle. But you've also got the first Native American who has been nominated to this post. I think that makes it a little bit harder for some senators to oppose. She's a Westerner. She's one of them. And I think, I think there's a good chance she gets through. But, yeah, there are going to be, as Brian mentioned, these hard questions about plans for oil and gas development. And I think, you know, with every administration, every time it changes, you see a change in policy. And that, you know, as Barack Obama once said, elections have consequences. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, she probably gets through, and I think the policies that Brian laid out probably are the way we're going. I would just note, too, though, that a lot of what has been driving oil and gas development trends in the West over the last few years has been the market. Oil prices are low to the point where leases that are already, you know, leased are not being developed. And so you kind of have this glut of oil and gas leases available, but the market isn't supporting, it doesn't make it economical for them to be developed right now. So the market will drive a lot of the future of this industry as well.
Well, and then, of course, maybe Brian Maffley, you know, climate change is happening. Fossil fuels are making it happen. Those are just the facts. The leasing of public lands for fossil fuels extraction, as Gerke's talking about, you know, there's a market that drives that. But does the leasing of public lands play significantly into Utah's contributions to climate change?
I think that's so speculative. Whether oil and gas leasing makes that big of a difference up or down. I mean, if Utah public lands aren't producing those coal and oil and gas resources, you know, some other state would really. And I think what the critics of the Biden administration would say is, you know, if these public lands aren't producing these fossil fuels, someone else will. It's the issue is on the demand side, not the supply side. Mm-hmm. I think in the grand scheme of things for climate, does it make that big of a difference if these lands are being leased in Utah? Who knows? But it does send a very powerful message when a U.S. president says, we're going to take climate change seriously to the point that we're going to limit oil and gas extraction on publicly owned lands. That's a pretty powerful statement to say, not only to Americans, but to the rest of the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, though. There's obviously, as you said, the demand side, the market that fuels that, that fuels the fuels that drive climate change. I plug a light bulb in my house in Utah or my apartment, and that is likely powered by coal-generated electricity. I guess.
Yes.
Well, I mean, that's a number of questions to answer there, and we have other news to get to, so maybe we won't dive into all of the energy sources here that need to be looked at. But a reminder to listeners that you can join this conversation. You can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW, or you can call 801-355-8255. Just before we head to a break, Brian, we're talking about the nominee for Interior Secretary here. And about public lands and, national monument designations in the state of Utah. You also wrote a story this week touching on a previous Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, and also having to do with the designation with review of national monuments. Zinke was Trump's first Interior Secretary. He led this review of national monuments that led to their downsizing. And there's an interesting parallel there about the idea that his review had a foregone conclusion at the end. That's some of the accusations that are directed at Deb Haaland as well, that her review will have a foregone conclusion to restore the size of the monuments. But one of the stories that you wrote this week touched on a private meeting that Zinke had with three county commissioners in Utah. There are some people out there who wanted to know what happened in that meeting. They had a legal victory this week. Kind of a confusing story and a relic from a bygone era, but explain this to us, Brian.
Yeah, well, it's pretty relevant now that another review is going to come along with another Interior Secretary coming to Utah. Yeah, so when Trump's Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, came to Utah almost 4 years ago now to review the future of those two monuments, well, he met privately with Kane in Garfield County's commissions who made their case for really shrinking the size of the Grand Staircase Escalade, way more than what Trump actually did. Just something like 200,000 or 300,000 acres. And it was done in meetings behind closed doors. The meetings weren't noticed. There weren't minutes. The public has, we have a good idea of what those commissioners said to Zinke, but it was done without the involvement of the public. And so the environmental group, Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, stepped in and filed a lawsuit over it, as well as a suit over Zinke's private meetings with the San Juan County Commission, where those commissioners, made their case for reducing the Bears Ears National Monument. And at the trial level of the district courts in Utah, they, sue and lost really badly. They were basically accused by these judges of bringing their suits in bad faith, and had to pay for the county's legal fees. It amounted to more than $50,000. And understandably, sue up. Appealed, and yesterday, the pair of rulings, they won. Their lawsuits were reinstated, so they don't have to pay the county's legal fees. And we're going to get this thing settled. When county commissions meet with, high-ranking federal officials, should those meetings be open to the public? Should they be noticed? That's a profoundly important question for the people of Utah. And it'll be nice to see some real guidance from the courts here, and that's what I think what good will come out of this.
Brian, just before we go to a break, and we do need to do that because we are burning through the clock. Will we, as a result of this, get an answer as to what? I mean, you said we could surmise some of what happened or guess what happened in that meeting. But will we get like some sort of readout, some sort of transcript of what occurred in this meeting?
No. Well, I think we'll never know what happened in those meetings. I think Sue is bringing this lawsuit to you know, establish some new ground rules about how these rural county commissioners engage with, federal land management people. The problem with them meeting in private with Secretary Zinke is they're going to give Zinke, they gave an extremely one-sided view that was not subjected to any kind of, rebuttal by people who were in those communities that supported the monuments. And believe me, there are a lot of people in Kane, Garfield, San Juan counties that support the monuments. And obviously there's a lot of people who want the monuments to go away.
Right.
But it seems that this is a legitimate question that Sewell raised, and they got really slapped down by two different judges for daring to bring their lawsuits. So I think this was, these decisions handed down by the Supreme Court, they were unanimous, and both were written by the Chief Justice, Matthew Durant. So I feel like the Supreme Court here was sending a pretty strong message here with these rulings. And I'm kind of looking forward to, I think all members of the media really should be looking forward to seeing how these cases play out, now that they'll be getting a shot at a hearing in the courts.
Sure, and seeing the light of day. Brian Maffley, Public Lands Reporter. Again, we are burning a lot of show here, and so we're going to have to leave this topic behind. I just want to say thank you for your reporting, and thanks for joining us. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. When we come back, we will turn to the penultimate week of the state legislative session. I'm Roger McDonough. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Brian Maffley and Taylor Stevens, as well as news columnist Robert Gerke. It is our live Friday morning Utah News Review, and you can join us for this conversation by calling 801-355-8255. Offer your questions and comments on the topics that we are covering today. You can also tweet to @KCPW. I'll have to check on Twitter to see if anybody has done that. An update to a story that we have been following for a number of weeks now. Taylor Stevens, House Bill 302, a bill to prevent transgender girls from participating in girls' school sports. This is a bill that elicited, a lot of strong reaction. It's apparently dead. Is that correct, Taylor?
Well, I say that no bill is ever dead until it's all over, because there's always a chance something can come up in the final hours, but it doesn't look like this bill in its current form clearly doesn't have the support it needs to move forward at this time in the process.
And why is that the case? How did it not proceed forward? I guess I know there was a suggestion of a veto from Utah Governor Spencer Cox. Did that play a role?
Yeah, I think it did. And this bill did pass through the House previously, but in coming into the Senate, after the comments from the governor, who really strongly spoke against this and some pretty emotional comments that he made last week, he worked with the bill's sponsor, Representative Kira Berkland, to make some changes to the bill. The main change that she presented this week to a Senate committee would have barred transgender girls from competing in competitions between schools, but would have allowed them to participate in public school athletics in other cases. The original version would have banned transgender girls from playing altogether, but that still wasn't enough for the Senate committee ultimately to support this. And after hearing a lot of public comment, having quite a bit of debate on this bill, the Senate committee ultimately did not take a vote on the bill. They just voted to adjourn without considering it. So a pretty good indication that it wouldn't have passed if they had taken a vote on it.
Hmm. There was, Taylor, a lot of public testimony during committee meeting. There was a lot of opposition to the measure. There was some support. And among the things that were brought up was the idea that, there was this supposed biological advantage of people who were born male competing as girls. There was a pediatric doctor who during testimony, said actually that for transgender kids, that's not exactly the case. Can you talk about that testimony, but also the back and forth, I guess, in people who are, you know, expressing public support or opposition.
Yeah, exactly as you said, you know, there was this argument from proponents of this bill that transgender athletes have this biological advantage, and they worried that if this bill passed, that this would be the end of female sports, as some of the proponents called it. But as you mentioned, there was an adolescent medicine doctor from the University of Utah testified, and she said that the physiological advantages that some people have mentioned don't actually exist. She says that, you know, just like with cisgender people, that we have variation in our physical strength and our physical abilities, and that that exists within people who are transgender, the same as within people who are cisgender. So she argued that that actually isn't really a good reason for supporting this bill. One thing that I'll mention that was in the version of the bill that the sponsor brought forward this week, she wants the legislature's Education Interim Committee to do some study on this issue, look at some findings from athletic organizations, see what competitive advantage, if any, of transgender girls in sports would actually be. And she sort of indicated a willingness to move forward with a bill that would just, you know, make the legislature do that study. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there is a chance possibly that this bill could come back in that form, just a study for the legislature to look at this issue, because she really strongly wants this topic to be under conversation. She wants, you know, this to be something that is being worked on. And so I think if we were going to see this bill come back, it might be in that form, just a study moving forward and no prohibition.
As a study. Obviously, the fact that it didn't advance was cause for celebration by people who opposed the bill. What kind of reaction was there?
Yeah, you know, this has been really emotional for members of the LGBTQ community who, you know, have talked a lot about how this proposal would send a harmful message to transgender students who are already struggling with belonging in Utah, you know, a conservative state. And so there was, as you said, kind of a celebratory environment. I would say definitely a lot of relief from those in the room who came to speak against this bill. You know, they know, I think, at the same time that this isn't going away, and that this is a conversation that will continue to be had. So in a way, it's sort of, you know, gearing up for the next fight, I think, for members of these LGBTQ communities.
Robert Gerke, news columnist. We've talked a lot about this one over the past couple of weeks. You know, this bill might be dead this session, but then, you know, the sentiment is still there. There's the idea of the study that Taylor is talking about. Do you expect this bill, you know, or the idea of trying to make this prohibition happen, do you expect it to come back at some point in the future?
Yeah, I mean, it's not going away. And it's kind of unfortunate that this wedge was driven between, you know, between communities by this bill. Because, again, as we've discussed on this show, it's not an issue that is playing out in Utah schools. One of these message bills that wouldn't actually accomplish anything or affect any real world scenarios. But it's an issue that, you know, is being discussed across the country. And I think if we had, you know, if the representative person at the outset had taken a thoughtful approach and brought parties to the table and discussed how we want to deal with this and got a better understanding of what the actual situation is, you know, you might be able to have worked out a solution this session. As it was, you know, proposing banning it is just not a viable option, and it's not a constructive course of action. So I think it will be discussed during the interim session, and I think there will be, you know, ideas brought to the table, and maybe there can be something that that they can agree on. And at the end of the day, I think one of the challenges that Representative Berkland has is she's got to show why the current policy of, you know, that the High School Activities Association has in place isn't working, because there's no indication that it isn't. And you know, then you can start looking at what other states are doing, what the NCAA is doing, what the U.S. Olympic Committee is doing in terms of testing for hormone levels and you know, determining competitive status that way. So I think there are options, there are paths forward that they could take if they choose to. But the way she approached this, and again, she's a freshman legislator, so I think maybe maybe this is a learning experience. But I think the way she approached this was undermined what she was trying to accomplish.
Hmm. I thought it was interesting that that Troy Williams, who's the executive director of Equality Utah, he mentioned that he doesn't see Representative Birkeland as an adversary or as a member of an opposing team, and talked about trying to find some common ground there. Actually, you know what? Let's move on to other stories, because again, we are running through the clock pretty quickly. I'll remind listeners to call 801-355-TALK or tweet to @KCPW. And Taylor, some more coverage from you up on the Hill. The name Dixie State University. There is a bill to effectively allow a name change for the school. That bill, seemed like it was doomed after some opposition to it, but there is the potential for it to be revived. It seems like there's some movement on that front. And so the school could still end up being called something else, the university, that is. Tell us the status of this one and how we got here.
Yeah, so this bill is still stuck in the Senate Rules Committee, which is sometimes sort of regarded as like a holding cell for bills that aren't moving. Okay. But legislative leadership did indicate this week that the bill will be heard before the end of the session. And what we're hearing might be likely is that there could be some changes to the bill. In the current version of the bill that we've seen, Dixie would be completely taken off the table. The new name could not include Dixie. This new change that we're hearing, it may allow the term Dixie as part of a compromise. We know that the House lawmakers really want this to move forward, but the Senate is much less willing right now to kind of bring this forward. Senate leadership has been concerned about some polling that shows Utahns at large don't want to share the name. However, there is research showing that the name is hurting students at the school. And so students showed up at the Capitol this week to advocate for the Senate to take this bill back up.
Yeah. And the school's board of trustees is also in favor of changing the name away from Dixie, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And this is really an interesting debate about the past and the future, because, proponents of the name, they really see it as part of their history, part of their culture and legacy. And students and those who want to see the name changed say that we need to be looking forward, that this is hurting students, that Dixie has some racist connotations and ties to the Confederacy, and that it needs to change. And so it's kind of that push and pull between holding on to the past and looking to the future. And we've seen that really play out in this debate.
Robert Gerke, Brigham Young sent people down to southern Utah to experiment with trying to produce cotton and actually wine as well. I don't know how well they did with those crops. I know that they did all right actually producing wine, but maybe not so much with cotton. The name Dixie was the name that stuck, I guess, because of the cotton experiment. But the connotation there is the Confederacy, not necessarily for the residents who are living in southern Utah, but for many of the people who students of Dixie State University are seeking jobs with after they graduate. What's your take here?
Well, I think it's the term Dixie is clearly a very loaded term, right? You can't separate that from the Confederacy. You can't separate that from its historic roots. While I take these people at their word that they don't intend any disrespect or any offense by it, you have to also look at how people outside of that environment view it. And so if you're, from out of state looking at going to a university and, you don't necessarily have you don't separate Dixie University from Dixie the Confederacy. And so people outside of the state are going to view it through that lens, because maybe they don't understand that Brigham Young sent people down there to pick cotton or grow cotton, and that was why it was named that. So while it's easy for residents who or steeped in that to try to rationalize it that way. I don't think that holds water when you're looking at a university that wants to have a statewide or regional or even national presence. And so I think they have to change the name. I think there's going to be resistance. It's going to be a process. But I think ultimately, at the end of the day, the name's going to change. And it'll be for the better. And it will help the university. It'll help its status. And it will shake off this the stigma that comes with a name that is steeped in the Confederacy and slavery.
Taylor Stevens, just to close this out, and actually we'll do another quick break and come back after this, but are there, you know, you mentioned the fact that it's basically on hold, and that we may see some amendments that would allow the word Dixie somehow showing up in the name. But are there any signs that it will make it to the finish line, the bill to allow a name change for Dixie State University, or do we just not know yet?
So legislative leaders in the Senate have promised that the bill will receive a hearing. So it will get a committee hearing. Whether it will get to the Senate floor, I think, is something that it remains to be seen, just depending on what the debate there is and the amendments that come forward. But, you know, kind of like with the last bill that we talked about, you know, I spoke with the Senate body president, the student body president at Dixie State, and she said, you know, this is an issue that has been discussed for decades, and it's not going away. So if it doesn't make it to the Senate floor, this, I think, is an issue that Utahns can expect to hear more about in the coming years.
Okay. You know, I want to tackle some more coverage you did from the legislative session, some gun bills, but let's save that for after another break. A reminder to listeners that you were tuned to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring the vital reporting you get from the journalists who work for the Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to take a quick break and be back in just a minute. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Brian Maffley, Taylor Stevens, and Robert Gerke. This is your live Friday morning local news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK. Back to the legislative session, and you can't actually call it a legislative session unless it has some gun-related legislation. Taylor Stevens, a bill to keep local jurisdictions from, you know, from placing their own restrictions on firearms or on the sale of firearms, maybe, or maybe it's a broader category than that. But this is House Bill 76. What is it all about, Taylor?
Yeah, this is a really interesting bill because, just to set the stage, Utah code already prohibits cities and counties from imposing regulations on guns. So that's ownership, possession, purchase, et cetera, et cetera. But something Salt Lake County did in late 2019 has upset that, you know, prohibition. So the county has owned some facilities, the Salt Palace Convention Center, the Mountain America Expo Center, that it holds, allows gun shows to be held at. And so the county, in its rules that it has for these institutions, it did something to close the what's called the gun show loophole. So they said that any I'm trying to think of the best way to explain this, but
sure.
Basically any gun that would be sold at these would have to go through a federal background check. And so previously that was not the case at these shows. So that is kind of the long wind up to say that this has frustrated the state legislature, and they want to make absolutely clear that cities and counties cannot do anything to prohibit the sale or purchase of guns. And so if this bill ultimately passes, it would unravel that rule change that Salt Lake County made within its county-owned facilities.
Okay. This is sort of about the, you know, the authority, who has the authority to regulate this particular issue. Taylor, maybe I'll just bring in the news columnist, the opinionator, the person who can chime in, Robert Gerke. You know, this is, again, about who gets to say what laws control the sale. I mean, in this instance, the Salt Lake County instance, the purchase and the purchase of guns in, you know, in their facilities. But is it a local jurisdiction issue? What do you see here?
Well, I mean, it is that. I mean, I wrote a few weeks ago how many of these bills are trampling on local control. I mean, the billboard bills were two that were both defeated that would have significantly limited local authority. This is one that where Salt Lake County tried to do something to ensure that there were background checks on gun sales, on private gun sales, and the legislature didn't want to have any of it. And it's kind of raises an interesting question, because what is the problem with having private with having a background check on private gun sales? I mean, are they concerned that it would limit the gun sales? It doesn't really create a burden, because they set it up so they can do these almost instantly and you know, at very low cost. And so it's really about control, and it's also going to, you know, potentially open the door for restricted people to be able to buy guns at a gun show, because there's not going to be a background check there that's required. I mean, this is something that's been a national debate for a long time. Do we close the gun show loophole? And the county tried to find a way around, I guess, the legislature's prohibition on municipalities and and county governments passing ordinances or making requirements that exceed the legislative prerogative. But they're not going to have any of it. And the legislature will ultimately have the final say. And it's like they're, you know, going to close down this effort by the county and reopen the gun show loophole at the county gun shows.
Taylor Stevens, just we'll move on to other things here in a minute, but this was almost a party line vote. There was one Republican from West Valley City who voted against the measure. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, he didn't really give much information about, you know, why he decided to vote against this bill. But the Democrats who voted against it argued that, you know, this move from Salt Lake County is reasonable, and that, you know, it's supported by members of the community based on polling we know. And so he just didn't think that this, as far as public safety, you know, and this is, I'm speaking about Representative Brian King, who did give a reason for his vote. He personally said he didn't think that this was a good move in the name of public safety. But as far as the West Valley Republican, Craig Hall, he didn't give any reason for his vote, so we're not sure.
Okay, got it. For some reason, I thought that Brian King's quote in your article was attributed to him. you know, we are close to the end of the show here, and so let's squeeze in one more story. I'm actually going to call kind of an audible here and shift away from guns to political parties, Taylor, a bill to restrict when a person might switch parties, or I guess when they might join a party. That bill is getting close to its final passage, right?
Yeah, so that bill passed yesterday in the Senate, and it needs one more procedural vote there before it heads to the governor. But, you know, all indications are that it will. And basically what that bill does is it would make it harder for voters to switch their political parties ahead of an election. And this comes after, and I think we talked about it on this show, but there were, you know, thousands of Utah voters who switched their party affiliation to become Republicans ahead of last June's primary election, so they could vote in the primary contest for governor. You know, the Republican Party only allows registered Republicans to vote in their primaries, and so they had to switch over to do that. And now, you know, lawmakers feel that that was an effort to, you know, quote unquote, game the system, and they want to crack down and stop people from being able to do that as easily.
What about, if you register to vote on the day of an election, you just can't do that. You wouldn't be able to affiliate with a party when you first register to vote, even if it's that near an election?
No. So if you are registering, this bill wouldn't apply for you. Same to unaffiliated voters who are, you know, they can switch up to, there's a certain time limit, March 1st, I think, but this would not affect those same-day party registers. So there are some carve-outs in the bill, but the main point of it is to keep people from being able to switch over and become Republicans who don't actually believe in the tenets of the party.
And again, this only applies to the Republican Party, because Democrats allow basically anybody to vote in their primaries. Is that correct?
Yeah, the primary effect it will have is of locking people out of the Republican primary, because, as you said, you know, the Democrats do have an open primary, so it would mainly affect that Republican GOP primary.
Robert Gricke, news columnist, is this bill solving a problem or not?
Well, I mean, I think, again, we talked about, you know, the legislature's desire to maintain control over all things. And this is sort of another attempt at that, right? I mean, they want to control who is able to vote in their elections and who isn't. And, you know, the problem with it, I guess, is that in Utah, most of, in a lot of races at least, the Republican primary is the one that is ultimately deciding who wins the seats, right? It's a Republican supermajority, and so those primaries matter. And, you know, people might want to vote in it, whether they consider themselves to be Republicans or not. You know, and the idea of a primary, though, is that people, members of a party, get to vote for their nominee. And so, you know, we can see why they might want to restrict that. There was a study that was done that said in the last election, it is by Princeton University, and it said in the last election, the crossovers, the people that registered as Republicans leading up to the gubernatorial primary didn't really factor into the results. And obviously we saw Spencer Cox win by a fairly large margin. So it's hard to argue that this has it's hard to point to an election and say, oh, well, it clearly made a difference here. But they're trying to head it off before it does. And so, you know, and they want to avoid an embarrassing scenario where they nominate somebody who doesn't necessarily espouse Republican ideals.
Taylor, you know, we're going to have to leave it here, but this bill on its way to passage?
Yeah, and, you know, we asked the governor this week if there were any bills he was looking at vetoing, and he wouldn't really give us those cards. So, you know, it'll be up to the governor now after this second vote in the Senate on whether this actually becomes law.
Okay. With that, we are going to have to leave it there in the interest of time and turn to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. And we actually have Brian Maffley, public lands reporter, still on the line. And Brian, we will give you first dibs on underplayed story of the week.
Hey, I appreciate that, Roger. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Yeah.
I'm going to have to say this legislation that Leah Larson's been following to establish a Utah Lake Authority. This bill would take the jurisdiction of the vast bed of Utah Lake away from the Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands and put it in the hands of this new board that would dictate, you know, what would happen to the lake. And it's almost as if they want to hand it over to developers or who knows,
It
seems like a pretty fishy enterprise.
Fishy. I like it. He's got a pun in there as well. You can find Leah Larson's article on the issues plaguing Utah's largest freshwater lake and this bill over at sltrip.com. Let's go, Taylor Stevens, to you with a pick for underplayed story.
Yeah, I want to highlight another story from Leah Larson with the Tribune. She has a profile on Utah attorney Bruce Baird and has a really fascinating look at how he has reshaped Utah's landscape one lawsuit at a time. He represents a lot of deep-pocketed developers, and so that's a really interesting story with a lot of colorful nuggets in it, so I would recommend give it a read.
It's a fascinating profile. It takes us from his, you know, mansion in Costa Rica to development projects in the state of Utah. Check that one out at sltrip.com. It is fascinating. Robert Gricke, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Well, I'm going to plug something that, of my own that I just posted today.
Okay.
There was a bill before the legislature that would have restricted at-home rape kits, do-it-yourself rape kits. And the notion being that, you know, if takes these rape kits, it produces evidence that isn't usable in court and also steers them away from, you know, getting the emotional, mental health, medical support that they might need. And so the legislature, Representative Angela Romero, was asking the legislature to prohibit these. New Hampshire has done this, and other state attorneys general have issued cease and desist orders to these companies that distribute these because they undermine getting victim support. And the legislature voted 5-3 not to approve that bill. And so they you know, as it stands now, these kits will be allowed to be sold in Utah when they come on market.
Which is bizarre because they don't actually have any evidentiary value, according to a number of prosecutors, because there's no chain of custody.
The most remarkable thing about that hearing was that you had prosecutors, you had defense attorneys, you had law enforcement, police chiefs, sheriffs, the attorney general's office, you had victim advocates, you had rape crisis counselors, you had doctors, all testifying that these are a bad thing, a bad idea, and should not be allowed to be sold. And the legislature ignored that and went ahead and permitted it anyway.
Okay. Thank you for that pick, Robert Gerke. I'm going to go with Lee Davidson, not a story by Lee Davidson, but about him. Tribune reporter, he is leaving the paper after quite a long run with that newspaper and others, and I've always appreciated his reporting and his insights on this show, and he will be missed. So a fond farewell to Lee. Thanks very much for your reporting. Robert Gerke, Taylor Stevens, Brian Maffley, all of the Salt Lake Tribune, we're going to leave it there. Thank you for joining me on the program today.
Thank you, Roger.
That does it for Behind the Headlines, which is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Tune in every Friday at 9 a.m. In fact, join us again next Friday. Have a great weekend, everybody.